Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/move to gas.
Now, about a year ago, our next guest was walking on Carron Toohill when something went seriously wrong. James Cahill can't remember that much about it, other than 15 members of the Kerry Mountain Rescue Team had to rescue him. After that, there was surgery in the Mater Hospital and then months at the National Rehabilitation Centre, during which James learned to walk again. James, good afternoon to you.
Thank you, Sean.
Thanks very much for coming into us today. What do you... I said you don't remember that much about it, but can you tell us what the weather was like that day?
Yeah, I remember a lot of what went on beforehand. I suppose we planned it for a week beforehand. There was a friend of mine, John Joe Culty. He's a local councillor here in Killarney, and I had met him a week previously at the Munster final, and he had told me that morning that he had climbed Carron Tool, and it was something I always wanted to do myself, and... I had tried previously on 3 occasions to arrange it, and it just didn't fall into place, clash with something or weddings or holidays or something like that. So he said, look, we'll go ahead and we'll do it next Sunday morning. So we made a plan for that, and we looked at the weather, and we were confident that the weather was going to be good. And I was looking forward to it all week. And we struck out on the Sunday morning. We met at 8 o'clock. And we were conscious that the morning wasn't great, but the forecast was reasonably good for the day, and we had checked the weather and stuff like that, and took off around 9 o'clock, and all was fine. And we got up as we started the ascending. The weather took a turn for the worst. Showers of rain came in, became very overcast, and windy as well.
How long does it normally take to climb it?
I suppose depending on your level of fitness. I hadn't climbed it before, so I was a relative newcomer, but would have been reasonably fit and reasonably athletic. But for normal people, I'd say about maybe 6 or 7 hours, taking a break and maybe to give yourself plenty of time. So we were cognizant of that. That's why we had set off pretty early.
Right,
and
okay.
And given ourselves plenty of time.
So had you made it to the top and you were on your way down?
Yeah, well, we didn't get fully to the top, because when we came very near the summit, the weather began to deteriorate. So John Joe, who would be a fairly seasoned climber, felt it was best that we'd start descending down, because he didn't think there was much point, you know, going much further, because the weather at that stage had begun to take a turn for the worse. And the thing was, we didn't want to be taking any further chances, so we began our descent in and decided that, you know, enough was enough. We weren't going to test fate any further.
Yes, right. Yeah. So you're on your way down, and what can you remember of the circumstances of your fall?
Yeah, all was going fine. We were, believe it or not, John Judd be extremely fit, so we were kind of jogging down. We were zigzagging across, you know, to kind of rough terrain. Some of it is relatively flat, some of it is rough. And I suppose on the way down, between everything, we kind of lost contact momentarily. Conditions deteriorated. The ground was a bit saturated. I went into a fall, a trip or a slip of some sort. What I can remember clearly is that as I did so, I kind of came out over a ledge. And within that time space, I had about 3 seconds before I knew I was going to hit the ground. And I just gave out a roar, a kind of a yelp, I suppose, with fright and fear. And John Joe was ahead of me. And the next thing I knew, I hit the ground. And once I hit the ground, I dropped about 40 feet. But there was that time lapse between actually coming over the edge of the ledge and actually hitting the ground that I actually remember. I can actually remember saying, I'm in trouble here. You know, this isn't going to end well.
Yeah, that must have felt like an eternity, I suppose, waiting for the impact.
Probably only 2 seconds, but so much goes through your head. Yeah. And you're in trouble at that stage.
And when you hit the ground, were you knocked unconscious, or do you have any memory of that?
I had about a minute. I can remember being conscious for a minute, but being in a totally confused kind of a state, a very kind of an agitated state, where I knew I wasn't going to stay conscious for much longer. I hadn't experienced this type of a feeling before. I was just confused and mixed up. And obviously, the most important thing, I knew straight away that, you know, the feeling had kind of gone out of my legs and had gone out of my arms. So I knew I had done some bit of damage, but, you know, loads of stuff racing through your head. And obviously, then I fell into unconsciousness and was drifting in and out of consciousness. And the next thing I remember was, you know, waking up and John Joe had me kind of had his knees, my head wedged in between his knees, and had me put in a fairly stable position. And he was, you know, talking to me and kind of reassuring me that I was okay and that, you know, the rescue services were on the way. But I suppose I was in a fairly agitated state at that time. I knew I had done some damage. I knew I couldn't feel my legs. I knew I was cold because I suppose your body temperature raises when you're walking, when you're active, and then, you know, when you have a lull for maybe half an hour or an hour, your body temperature drops fairly quickly. And I was freezing, and the wind had risen as well, and we were in a kind of elevated plateau. And I suppose after that, then it was hazy enough, bits and pieces. Mm. John Joe had got a phone signal, I suppose, which was lucky for me.
Yeah.
He managed to make one call because his phone got wet. He made the magic call, I suppose. He made the call to the rescue services. And the rest, I suppose, is down to the capable hands of the Kerry Mountain Rescue.
And to get you down, I did mention it was like 15 different people. How did they get you down the mountain physically?
Well, I don't remember much about the getting down bar. You know, one of the lads from the Mountain Rescue Service came to me a couple of months after my accident, and he explained the whole process. So it was a fairly complicated affair because, you know, we were at a fairly steep incline. Access would be poor. Conditions were bad, so it was a whole process of a team of 15 people. I suppose, first of all, securing the site and I suppose administering whatever medical attention I needed, securing me in a safe position, and then basically lowering me down on a stretcher and taking turns to actually rope me down and secure me onto different positions as we came down, and eventually got me down. And there's a river, for anyone who knows the area, there's a river at the actual base of the mountain, and that was fairly high on the afternoon that I came down because of the rain and the runoff from the mountain, and getting me then into the helicopter. And that's one of the clear memories I do have. I obviously came back into some state of consciousness when I got back down, because I can remember clearly seeing the red helicopter and the 115, the lettering 115 emblazoned on the outside of the helicopter. And I knew then I was in fairly
but
safe hands.
You'd already known that something, you'd hurt yourself quite severely. You'd already known you couldn't move your legs.
Yeah.
At what point then, subsequent to that, did someone come in and explain this is exactly what the damage is?
Yeah, well, I suppose it evolved then over a period of a couple of days, really. I was carted off in the helicopter, and you know when you see a helicopter, you know you're in trouble. You know if it's not an ambulance or a helicopter, that there's something fairly serious. So I suppose I got to Tralee in fairly quickly, I think 7 or 8 minutes, and I had facial surgery and stuff like that, and then stitching. And when I woke up, my family were there, and you know I knew that my limbs, both my lower and my upper limbs were in trouble. So it was explained to me then. I had a CT scan, and it was explained to me that I had done damage to my cervical area. C2 and C4 specifically had been damaged, and when they were damaged, they squeezed the spinal cord, and that obviously affects your central nervous system and the transmission of nerves and messages, and that was the crux of where I was, really, you know. Mm. I suppose then it was a matter of establishing the extent of the damage and correcting that damage then. And you know, I suppose initially I thought that once the damage would be corrected, that hunky-dory would be all ready to go again, but it doesn't work like that. When you damage your spinal cord, you can have what's called a complete injury or an incomplete injury. Fortunately for me, mine was an incomplete injury. So I didn't suffer maybe just semi-permanent damage. Permanent damage would have meant that I would have been paralyzed from the shoulders down. Which I was initially, but you know, over a period of a couple of weeks, then I had surgery in the Mater Hospital in Dublin, where they actually they did cervical surgery, where they actually do a bridging process between your C2 and C4 vertebrae, and they actually strengthen it. The surgeon explained that it was a bit like putting an RSJ into a building, basically. Yes. That was how he described it. Basically, connecting your two vertebrae and strengthening them. And he assured me after that my vertebrae were probably stronger than they were prior to the accident, but that still left me with the damage and the rehabbing and the position I was in, which was basically paralysed from the shoulder down.
You were given a wheelchair, but you didn't get into it.
I was. Well, I had no other choice. I had to go into the wheelchair
initially.
Because I was basically going from bed to wheelchair, basically being hoisted from a bed to a wheelchair to a gym to an occupational therapy room. But when you're in the rehab, in the national rehab, the wheelchair becomes part of your daily living. And for some people, even to get to a wheelchair is an achievement. In my case, I suppose, maybe naively or not, I felt it was only going to be a means to an end, and that was always in my mind. I never got any assurances or reassurances about that, but that was always my motivation.
I was wondering about that, because I suppose they don't know what the eventual outcome will be.
They don't, Sean. Initially, I would have got a fairly negative prognosis. That was on the day that I had surgery in the matter. I suppose they're looking at a scan, and you know, nothing in medicine is black or white. There's always grey areas, and my scan showed a lot of grey areas as well. And you know, my surgeon did say, you know, while the corrective action had been good and had gone smoothly, that you know, there was a lot of damage done to the spinal cord, and that, you know, he would have fears with regard to certain aspects of my mobility going forward. But that's the type of stuff you don't want to hear at that stage. And, you know, I suppose it goes in one ear and out the other ear, and you plow on, you know.
But the attitude of the person must be a factor here, because it seems as if you were determined to get back on your feet again, literally.
I think I'd be the same as anyone else. When you sustain an injury like that, I suppose your first reaction is to feel sorry for yourself. And you go through periods of, you know, feeling sorry and being, I suppose, half depressed and, you know, narky. And then you suddenly look around you in the hospital and you see people who are in far worse condition than you. And you see their attitude and the positive thinking they have. And, you know, your family then play a huge part. My wife and kids and my extended family were fantastic. You know, they were constantly there with me. And, you know, I'd be fairly determined as well, I suppose. You know, want to try and get your life back. And I suppose that leads you on the road that you take then, and you can either sit down and take it, or you can get up and try and fight it. And I chose the latter so far.
It's hard, though.
It's a hard road, yeah. But I suppose I saw it as a road that I had to take. I saw it that I had been given an opportunity. You know, I got a chance to kind of get my life back. There was loads of other colleagues and patients up there who hadn't been given that chance, who had suffered fairly serious damage. And, you know, when you see a window of opportunity, you try and take it, and, you know, you give out, and I suppose you bitch and stuff, but you deep down, you know that you have to keep going, and you know that, you know, you give it your best shot. And I suppose it's a fantastic hospital in terms of the work that the professionals up there do. You get fantastic care, and they work you hard. But they motivate you as well, and you know, I think I was lucky. I had great people around me as well.
I assume it's an ongoing process.
You're back walking again, but you get
better and better.
Yeah, it's a process. I mean, the nature of spinal injuries is that the rehab is slow, progress is slow, and I suppose the secret is to persevere. A lot of people give up, you know, when they leave the hospital and they don't maintain the momentum, but. You know, I was lucky, I was fortunate. When I left the hospital, I kind of kept the momentum going. And when I got home, I probably improved more, because you just have a window of maybe 12 to 14 weeks in the hospital. Whereas when you come out, you know, you're exposed to more opportunities, and you're in your home environment, and you're with your family and you're with your friends, and you can work harder, and I suppose you have more support as well.
One day, do you see yourself going back up Karen Tugel again?
It wouldn't be something to be on my mind at the moment, Sean.
There is something on your mind more immediately. Is it next weekend?
Next weekend, Sean, yeah. Next weekend. Look, we said at the time that, you know, we were very grateful for the involvement of the Mountain Rescue. Were it not for them, I'd probably be still up there. And they do fantastic work, and I suppose it's work that up to now or previously I wouldn't have been aware of, but when you become part of an incident yourself, you appreciate what they've done. So the family got together, and a group of friends of mine there, and they have organised this walk, which is basically a Thanksgiving walk, really, for what the Mountain Rescue people have done. They're a voluntary organisation. You know, they're all doing this on a voluntary basis. They're all people who work 9 to 5. They're not funded by the state, so all their fundraising is done locally. So we wanted to do this just as a token of our appreciation for the work they do. You know, Kerry is fortunate that it's surrounded by mountains, and we're fortunate that we have that group of people here to help out to any people who become stricken on the mountain. And it's a fairly regular occurrence because leisure tourism and walking and mountaineering are a huge part of this town, and you know, the Kerry Mountain Rescue are a huge part of the first responders that are there when an event takes place.
James, thanks so much for coming in to tell us your story today. James Cahill, ladies and gentlemen.
Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big cheque for the delivery guy? GasNetworks.ie/movetogas.